I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by Devin Morrow. Devin is a graduate of the University of Winnipeg and York University in political sciences. She was an English teacher in Sulaimani, Iraq, at the International School of Shuafat, teaching, amongst other things, English to young Iraqi children. She brings with her an interesting story, having been through a lot in the region and having some interesting insights from Winnipeggers seeking to understand more about the conflict in the Middle East. And so we're really, really pleased to have her in the studio today. Welcome, Devin.
Thank you.
How's it going?
It's going great.
Devin's about to get on a plane in about 12 hours to go to Toronto and head back to Iraq. So we're really fortunate she's making some time here for us today. So Devin, I want to talk about the situation in Iraq, and I want to talk about your experiences there. But briefly, for those of us who might not be as familiar with the situation in the Middle East, really broadly speaking, or even the situation in Kurdistan particularly, can you walk us through what the current climate is like in your city and how some of the experiences you had there?
Absolutely. I live in Sulaimani, which is in the southeastern area of Kurdistan, which is in northern Iraq. It is a bit out of the current conflict that's happening right now, which is more in the north and west part of the country. Back in middle of June, Islamic militants, ISIS, which is now the Islamic State, IS, invaded and took Mosul, which is a large city in northern Iraq that is technically in Iraqi territory, not Kurdish territory, but the province around it is Kurdish. Over the last 2 months since then, ISIS has made huge gains in the area around Kurdistan, mm-hmm. which is northern Iraq.
Right.
The biggest issue, obviously, which I'm sure many people have heard and read because it was shocking, was the slaughter of Yazidi peoples in northern Iraq that are technically seen as part of the ethnic Kurdish group, but they don't see themselves as Kurdish. The Kurds do count them as Kurds, but they are a separate ethnic and language and religious group. They live west of Mosul, but mm-hmm. this is still in a Kurdish territory. So even though Mosul is Iraqi territory and it fell to ISIS, the region around it is not technically Iraqi, it's Kurdish. And the Yazidis who were slaughtered by ISIS have now fled towards Kurdistan, which is east of them, around Mosul. So within Kurdistan itself right now, ISIS hasn't made any gains. It's still a safe territory that's completely defended by the Peshmerga, which are the Kurdish military. Mm-hmm. But the area surrounding Kurdistan it's hot right now.
Very hot.
Mm.
What's within that climate? What is the current political situation between the states that are bordering on Kurdistan or the Kurd region?
To the north, you have Turkey, and Turkey is a very well-defended border. That it's unlikely ISIS will make any gains into it because Turkey has a hugely powerful military. And they also have interest in keeping that base defended because of the oil pipelines that go between Kurdistan and Turkey. To the east, there is Iran, and it's a Kurdish region of Iran as well. However, it's completely also isolated from ISIS, and they are sending support through Kurdistan to support the Peshmerga. The biggest issue, of course, is the west, which is Syria, which is where the Islamic State has made the most, gains in the last couple of months, well, the last probably 2 years, but more recently in the last month, they've had huge gains across northern Syria, which are basically 100% ISIS-controlled at this point.
How do you think that the Canadian media, or maybe more broadly, the Western media portrays that area of the world relative to your experiences there?
I think that across the board, though, the reporting that ISIS is 100% basically this evil terrorist extremist group is fairly accurate. The Kurds are thrilled with international support right now. Like, they're a group that is so right-wing and so extremist, and they're slaughtering anyone who does not agree with them. So I think in that sense, it's for the first time ever, it's a fairly accurate portrayal of a independent militia group in that part of the world without being too alarmist. However, I think that as far as Kurdistan goes, I know a lot of my friends and family are concerned about my going back to Sulaimania, which is actually okay because I know it's a small area on the map, but it is far enough away from the fighting, which is more in the northwestern part of the country, closer around Erbil. The biggest issues right now in Kurdistan are the massive influx of IDPs and refugees from across northern Iraq, as well as within Erbil area and around Kirkuk area. So there's rising gas prices, which is huge. There is an increased presence of refugees and IDPs, which can't be provided for by the Kurdish state. And there is increased military presence. But none of those are contributing to any safety concerns in Suli, where I live.
From your perspective, how are international military forces working in a way, or working in a cohesive or non-cohesive way to deal with this rising and more serious threat?
I've never ever been pro-intervention in my life. I've always been very anti-American intervention. This is for the first time that I would say that it's necessary to be contained. I don't know. There were some interesting articles or interviews and articles in the last couple of days about what it will mean to cooperate with Assad in Syria. And that, to me, is a huge issue because in some way, by participating in an international coalition that will go after ISIS, they were first operating in Syria, and they are one of the rebel factions in Syria. There are other factions that are not remotely related to them. But in some way, by participating in an international coalition that will stop them, you are somehow cooperating with the Assad regime, which is a really complicated thing, and I think a very negative thing to even consider entertaining.
But certainly nothing new. I mean, the United States has partnered with dictators, human rights offenders for decades. I mean,
for sure.
After World War II, even in the liberal era. Mm-hmm. What makes this conflict different in your mind that it warrants that degree of liberal interventionism in this case?
I think there's a number of reasons. A lot of people are talking about this American responsibility towards Iraq, which I think is kind of is total crap. And I think there's a number of different interests. One probably is oil, but that's not the main one. I think that they are interested in a Kurdistan that is strong because of it is probably going to be the growing democracy in that part of the world that's been actually the most stable area since 03, or you could look at that prior. And I'm not sure. I would like to think that there's a responsibility, especially after the Yazidis issue. I mean, there was like 1,000 people being killed on Sinjar Mountain, more than thousands. And it was reported by friends of mine that are in the know that disaster would be bigger than Halabja, which is when the Kurds were gassed by Saddam Hussein in the late 80s. I would like to think that this responsibility to protect Kurds and Yazidis is exactly that. There's so much outrage over a number of different things happening in the world right now. You have Gaza, you have so many other places where it seems like leaders are quite crippled by decisions. And this is like a space that it seems like it's actually an easy answer because the Iraqi government is very weak. The Kurdish government is welcoming this intervention. It will also at some point eventually have some sort of effect on Syria, which people have been calling for a long time. So I think these are all aspects that are contributing to some sort of international intervention into it.
What is always interesting to me is about what people don't understand about a place. What do people not understand here in Winnipeg about the environment that you're going back to?
I think primarily people don't understand the situation of Kurdistan. You know, I will often say I live in Iraq because it's easier than explaining I live in Kurdistan, which my Kurdish friends would be horrified if they knew that I was saying that, you know, and because we don't live in Iraq. I mean, I can't get a visa to go to Iraq properly. It's a semi-autonomous state within a larger state that has a lot of issues. But I think that it's a really unique space that very few people are really acquainted with and understand that it is, you know, for that part of the world, it's the most stable democracy and it's quite liberal. It's very welcoming towards all the refugees it has acquired from all across the region. Kurds are like a really family-driven, complex people with a long history in that whole region. And people often also ask me, like, Kurdistan, well, are you in Turkish Kurdistan? I'm like, no, I'm in Kurdistan, which is its own semi-autonomous state within Iraq, but it's full of Iraqi Kurds. It's not full of Turkish, it's not like as though Iranian or Turkish or Syrian Kurds are fleeing to Iraqi Kurdistan. You know, it's a complex society. It's four different dialects. It's different peoples from around a huge region. So I don't think, I didn't know a lot about it when I got there. You know, it was just over the last year that I've been there that I've been able to understand just how rich and complex that society is.
Do you feel an obligation to clarify those complexities and work within them, particularly within a mass media society, which likes to ignore complexity and focus on headlines?
Absolutely. And right before I came back to Winnipeg, my mother visited me in Sulaymaniyah, and she participated she started her own fundraising drive in Winnipeg for children who are Syrian Kurds that are currently in refugee camps outside of my city. And the main thing I asked her was to clarify. She was on CBC and CTV, and I was like, can you just clarify that you're not they're going to Iraq, but these people kept kind of referring to it as just this Iraq, this like monolithic area that exists that's terrifying. And it's like, no, it's, you're going to Kurdistan. Just, can you just clarify to everyone that that's where you're going, as opposed, I mean, for, by all means, obviously say Iraq, but I just think that it's not clarified enough that it is like a distinct region.
One of the most interesting elements to hit the media recently was the tragic death of war journalist James Foley. Mm-hmm. How do you look at that event, and how does that affect your willingness or eagerness to go back to that region?
It doesn't affect me in my choice to go back. It does make you have a moment, though, of realization that this is happening. And actually, within the first week, the bigger thing for me was in the very first week of this event, of this conflict, back in June, a Kurdish journalist went missing. He was presumed dead. And it was within the first 3 days. He was in Kirkuk. He was apparently shot and possibly fell off of an army convoy. No one really knows. It's assumed that he's dead. The Guardian reported as the first journalist to be killed. And the thing that to me was that actually a number of my friends were quite good friends with him. His name is Kamaran. He was a brilliant journalist. He started a brand new photo agency in Suli called Metrography. And I think that loss to me was a much stronger, what are we doing here, kind of, because it was somebody that I'd met, you know, that I'd spent time with, that I have friends that were very close with him, and he just disappeared. I think we read about James Foley and It's tragic and horrifying, but sadly, it's happening more and more to journalists, and that you let that affect you, you go anywhere, I think.
Mm-hmm. Who's writing these days that has an interesting perspective or is putting information out there that is making this enduring and you know, centuries old and you know, multi-layered conflict more understandable right now?
I think it would have to be a lot of the smaller journalists that are there and based there and have been freelancing for a long time. The issue with these kind of conflicts is that suddenly, you know, by June 20th, everyone was an expert, and everyone was writing about Kurdistan and Iraq and whether or not it's the U.S. responsibility and what was the U.S.'s role in this and all of these kind of large issues, and a lot of like very, you know, prominent journalists are writing about it. And suddenly everyone's an expert. And I think that is not going to last. It's the people that have been in that region for a long time doing the small stories about everyday life that they have a much richer understanding of it. Certainly a number of people that I know that I think are doing an excellent job of reporting. Luke Coleman freelances for Al Jazeera. He's in Erbil. He's prolifically on social media just to follow his updates. It's been fascinating because he has such an excellent insight because he's been there for a number of years and he's been writing for a number of years. Other like radio correspondents that I know there, mostly for foreign outlets, but they're the ones that are getting the stories that matter because they know who to talk to and where to find people. And I think that it's the smaller names that you don't recognize that are going to be the ones that stand out, as well as actually an excellent source that I like is a lot is Al Monitor, which is a...
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And it's a lot of smaller name journalists are in there. And they're just kind of... I mean, they're putting their neck on the line for sure, but they are getting the stories.
You had an interesting experience at the end of May that I think caused a lot of concern among some friends and family. Can you share it with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I was cooking at the end of May in Kurdistan. I was still employed. And my stove exploded as I was cooking. There was a massive gas explosion. I was very badly injured, and I magically survived through some unknown reason.
How did people react when they found out?
It's the most unexpected, shocking thing to happen. It was like I had really overwhelming support, which is what got me through the recovery, which is very long and very slow. And I did all of it in Kurdistan. Because they happen to have a lot of burn survivors there for a whole other reason. But I think, I mean, I was just very lucky in that I had people there that were very supportive and caring for me. And you have to have that. You have to, the whole medical system is built on an assumption that you have a family to support you. And my friends there were my family and supporting me in getting well. And I mean, coming back here, it's been overwhelming as well. And that kind of thing happens to you and you kind of, you know, start realizing how short life is, maybe how long life could be. I don't know. It's a very difficult thing to understand when you kind of face your mortality very abruptly.
given that the medical system is structured heavily around having a family and having those additional supports in Kurdistan, what type of government supports from the government of Canada exist for Canadians traveling in that region or living in that region?
That's actually a good question. Right now, this is the issue, that it's a void all essential and non-essential travel, so the supports are not great. There's no embassy in Erbil. The closest one is in Amman, which is in Jordan. There's a lot of nonprofit support there. I had medical coverage from my company, but I didn't have to use it because the burn unit is a public space that everyone is provided for, including massive amounts of physiotherapy and a number of other aspects. Like, I was, when I left my last day, I was kind of like, what's this bill going to be? And it was non-existent. But the Canadian government, I'm sure, were I an embassy staff or somebody who is there for a, you know, supported reason, would be protective. But I mean, it's, who knows right now with the way things are changing. They don't have an embassy.
You've written online very, very beautifully, I think, about the experience in the burn ward and your relationship with some of the other women who are in the burn ward. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, and thank you. I didn't realize when I got to the burn unit how busy it would be. I don't know how busy burn units are in Canada, but I was shocked by the number of people that were there and the number of people that were predominantly women. And that's because Kurdish women have, it's this incredibly tragic thing. There's a number of women who self-immolate in Kurdistan, which means setting yourself on fire as a form of attempted suicide. Only about half of them are successful in their suicide. The other half end up at the burn unit. And about half of all female suicide attempts it's by fire. And I was just, to me, that was such a shocking thing. And I never knew that. And I don't think anybody does. It's not covered. It's a very private, family-oriented culture. And there's a lot of structural violence and patriarchy within families, which means that kind of just keeps growing for me, because that means that women have no way out. So they're trying, their only way out is set themselves on fire. And they're using that form of suicide because it's seen as an accident and they don't want to shame their children or their family, which is just a whole other layer of complexity that, you know, to have to think that through. And then also to survive that and be in the burn unit. I was lucky. My burns were like deeply second degree burns, so I didn't require skin grafting, and they were like on my face, chest, arms, and feet. Most women there, because they wear these beautiful long covered dresses that are mostly made of polyester and other flammable materials, are just the kinds of injuries you see are just, I can't imagine. My own pain was so excruciating. I can't imagine what it would have been like to be in this kind of clothing when that happened. And then also the bigger issue is that then to survive, and recovery was so unspeakably awful and hard. You know, you have to be so motivated to get yourself better. That's a huge aspect of it. And to have survived a suicide attempt by fire and have to go through that process, I can't imagine how difficult that would be. Further, when there's no nurse support, so you have to have your family come in, unwind your bandages, and wash you every day. And to know that you've tried to escape that family, I just, it was many things to think about, and I spent a lot of time there thinking about it. And I think that it's an issue that doesn't get nearly enough coverage. There is more of it in the last couple of months prior to this conflict happening. But I think that I can't imagine that feeling of being that trapped, and that's your only way out.
As somebody who can identify those things, and I would imagine identifies as a feminist, absolutely, how do you take that experience in the burn ward and use it in your next life and in your new return to Kurdistan?
I'm still figuring that out, and it's something that I think about a lot, because I literally had no idea before. And I was aware of this level of patriarchy based. I was a teacher in Kurdistan, and the women I worked with and the parents of the children I was with. But I think that that's something that affected me very strongly, and that one of my intentions to go back is to work more closely in that area, because I think it's incredibly important, and it's so, I guess, just not known about. And that to me is shocking and quite awful. And I think that the first step is awareness and advocacy. I don't know what kind of programming there is for women in Kurdistan, But there isn't as much as there are in other developing and post-conflict situations. I honestly think there's the bare bones of it, but there's no kind of programming that brings women together. And I think that traditionally in Kurdish families, women worked very closely and shared. It's very large families, and they had this kind of, you know, behind closed doors way of cooking together or everything else. And decades of conflict has really disrupted that family dynamic, where families are a bit more separated now. They're still very important, but there's not this sharing culture, you know? Everyone's a bit more on their own. Not remotely the way that, you know, individuality exists in Canada, for example. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's something to be said for creating safe space for women to get together and discuss or just share their time. And the burning, it was the first time I'd seen that many women together ever in a group.
Which doesn't happen in public spaces.
No, right. No. Even in the markets. And the markets are entirely men. It's like it's a man's world, absolutely, in Kurdistan. Women are always behind closed doors, which would be, you know, okay if they are allowed to have their own society behind those closed doors. But it seems like as everything progresses and people want larger houses and they want to be a bit more westernized, they're actually individualized more. So women lose that sense of community that they would have had, you know, decades before, where it was larger spaces and that kind of thing.
So they're losing out within the losing out. I'm not sure if that's the exact term to use, but they're being disadvantaged by the patriarchal structure that existed. And as this new Western individualism starts to infiltrate into Kurdistan, and then it gets them again in that point in time.
It's like modernity is kind of screwing them up even worse in some way, you know?
Right. So I've worked for Canadian NGOs in the past and been very disappointed by the level of acumen that most NGOs have towards these types of situations. And broadly speaking, most NGOs, I think, confuse what actually is needed in an area with what they want to do.
Absolutely.
Are there any organizations that people can look at or that you've experienced or worked with in this region that are taking a look at the issue of development and of human well-being from a feminist perspective?
I don't know. And because of that, I don't think so. You know, I think I would know about it if it existed. My biggest issue with a lot of development NGOs is exactly that they have their own idea of what's supposed to happen versus what actually happens. And that's why I find it very difficult to like get behind a lot of these causes, you know, whether it's like building schools or whatever. It's like, do you even know what the long-term ramifications of that are? And actually, as a teacher, I have to clarify that, I mean, I was in Kurdistan teaching English, which I think is the most imperial thing a person can do. And I'm participating in that, you know, immediately, which is why I chose not to renew my contract. I couldn't quite grapple with that situation. And it wasn't teaching kids in a refugee camp. It was teaching kids at an international school with rich parents, work in the oil industry or work in, you know, whatever else, business. And to me, that was just a bit too much to kind of have to compromise myself with.
It is a funny question, though, because we are always going to have to compromise something in order to experience something new. And you mentioned that imperialism and the notion of subjecting a culture upon another culture, mm-hmm. certainly in the modern day, not only sort of functional imperialism, military dominance is popular, but as we talk about, you know, Western culture infiltrating parts of Kurdistan, we also see cultural imperialism, and certainly teaching English would be part of that. Mm-hmm. Teaching English is also extraordinarily popular among students, even here at the University of Winnipeg, who
absolutely
work abroad. How do we reconcile those contradictions as we want to learn more about the world and the inevitability of changing it, either in intentional ways in your case or in unintentional ways in other cases?
I don't know. And that's a huge issue for me because I'm trying to figure that out. And I think that what it came down to for me was that I was participating in a project in Sri Lanka with an NGO a couple of years ago, and it was a reintegration project for former child combatants, which meant that we were trying to bring them back into their communities and help them reintegrate with their families, help them find vocational work, go back to school, whatever it was. And to me, the outcome of that project was not... The idea was fantastic. Obviously, it's important for that to happen. But the outcome was just a number of issues I was disagreeing with as far as the way it was structured and the way success was measured, which I think is a really, this happens all the time in NGOs, especially overseas ones, that measure success by numbers or by months achieved or something. And to me, that makes very little sense, which is why my cause has then turned to landmines, which I worked with Mines Action Canada last year, because to me that's like one of the very few black and white issues in the world is arms control, and that became kind of more my, I could get 100% behind it. I didn't have to grapple with anything. It was like they are inherently bad for a number of reasons, you know, and the landmine treaty exists for those reasons, because so many civilians die because they're in the ground for so long, because they are active for so long. And so I originally went to Kurdistan with the intention that I was going to network and use my time there as a teacher to build contacts in the disarmament world, either landmines, small arms, light weapons, that kind of thing, which has been, I've been actually rather successful in that. And then that's what I'm intending to go back to do, really, because it's kind of one of the few things that I think is absolutely black and white, that arms control has to be addressed. And it's not a humanitarian development, or not traditionally seen as that, but it has a direct impact on civilians. And that's easier for me to understand than building schools or teaching or building wells or, you know, all of these things that have such massive ramifications in the communities, which without us really realizing it, and I say us as in Western NGOs that have these, you know, great ideas, but they don't always understand the complexity of the societies that they're jumping into.
The number of people who engage with that opportunity and that avenue with good intentions and end up causing harm is huge. And it's interesting because it's the number of people who recognize they're causing harm is large. The amount of people who don't is even bigger.
It's even bigger. And that's like, that's why I don't really know. Like, it's so easy too, because anyone can do it and it pays really well. And you kind of be like, okay, I'm going to like use this time to better myself and I can volunteer, you know, like you have all these kind of ways you compromise. And I guess you always have to compromise, but like, I don't really know when you stop. And some of the teachers I knew, like, they're lifer teachers. They're there. They just kind of lost all their ideals a long time ago. And they just, like, live an awesome life because they make so much money and it's rent-free. And they just get to bounce around. And I don't think I could do that.
What are you going back to?
That is the million-dollar question that everyone's asking me, because it's sort of, I have a number of people there. I don't actually have a job yet, which is the big issue. But I mean, there's enough things happening, and I have enough contacts in my field, both refugees and arms control, that it's very likely I can find something once I'm on the ground. And I think this is the thing, like, once you're there, it's much easier because people want you immediately, as opposed to like the process of getting an overseas contract is huge, because you have to be like vetted and flown, and it's usually like a number of weeks and or like a month or two. So it is easier if you're there. You know, I have a lot of friends that have flitted around various contracts because they're already on the ground. It's just easier to be hired that way.
Embracing uncertainty and embracing complexity. Devin, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Devin Morrow blogs at storiesfromyescape.wordpress.com. And she's soon to be heading to Toronto and then back to Kurdistan. But she made time to speak with us today. You're listening to CKW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg, Manitoba.